Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. I invite you, as always, to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and ask you to subscribe. With me, as always, executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And yet again, back from her vacation, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Okay, I want to read you guys something that popped up in my memories on Facebook. If you guys are on Facebook, you know that every day now they send you something that you posted on the day, on that date in previous moments, you know, previous years. And this is what came up. For August 4th, 2016, quote, this is something I wrote, posted on Facebook. Most likely Trump is finished. National poll last night, 49-39 Clinton. State polls, New Hampshire 47-32, Michigan 41-32, Pennsylvania 49-38. If these numbers track at all with reality, Republicans will lose the House and Senate as well. Near extinction level event for GOP. Wake up, Trumpkins, you burn down the joint. So, oddly enough, if you look at today's polling, that was a poll that had Trump down by 10 on August 4th, 2016. And in the Real Clear Politics average today, in the Real Clear Politics average today, Biden is up 7.4. So Biden is arguably doing worse than Trump is doing better than he was in 2016 today, August 4th. And Biden is doing worse than Hillary. Well, actually, it's not worse because he's at 49 in the average. As I cited, those terrible polls in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and New Hampshire. So, of course, he won Pennsylvania and Michigan, and he came very, very close in New Hampshire. So, Christine, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting, but I will add, I think we've long said that Trump is unique, and I do think that it's unique. We should look at him in that sense and look at those numbers from 4 years ago in this way. It's usually the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. But as I think the Axios interview that he just did with Jonathan Swan revealed, the more we see and hear of Trump, the more incompetent he seems to be for this particular moment, which is quite different from 2016. So I am much more skeptical that this suggests he could rebound and win again. Even though we were all wrong about the numbers for 2016, I feel like now we've seen him in the midst of several crises be the devil we know, and we don't really like that. Like the sense of needing a change is still going to overcome his hope that he can pull this election out like he did in 2016. I think the circumstances are so different and his deficiency is so glaring at this point that it would be a much harder slog for him.
Abe?
I think it's very valuable that popped up because I don't think Trump is sunk. I think he's in the game. Doesn't mean I think he's going to win. I think he might win. His vast array of deficiencies were pretty glaring in 2016 as well, on display every day. I think there are actually certain parallels that I was just thinking of over the past couple minutes while you guys were talking between this moment and 2016, despite the fact that this is a unique crisis or that we're going through several unique crises. There was the sense after Trump won in 2016 of, well, of course, what did we think? Hillary was so extraordinarily polarizing, right? Might there not be something in Biden, not polarizing, but couldn't you see the, well, of course, Biden was a mess. You know,
you mean after the fact?
Yeah.
You can diagnose.
Precisely.
You can see what the diagnosis would be.
Right.
If Trump prevails.
After the fact, right.
Right.
And in 2016, there was this, well, it makes some sense, also in as diagnosis, well, it makes some sense because the country had just gone so far left. They were just pushing on every front leftward. So look at the current moment where the left inspired upheaval is absolutely everywhere. So I think as with 2016, we risk ignoring these atmospheric influences in favor of the polls that may or may not be reflecting what's going to happen.
Well, it's interesting then because Noah, let me ask you this. Is the fact that there is a established dynamic in the electorate, this negative polarization dynamic, that means that we can already see that Trump benefits from, in the sense that you generally look at the sort of the collection of facts of the moment, you know, the economy that dropped annualized 33% in a quarter, the pandemic, the loss of his major talking point, which is that he did such a great job in the economy, that nonetheless, he's still in the game itself is an indication that maybe it doesn't matter what he does, and in a funny way, it doesn't necessarily matter what Biden does. The question is the atmosphere in the country the sort of atmosphere that means that he will get reelected or means that Biden will get reelected, that what they do isn't going to matter? Biden may look mentally deficient. Trump, in his own way, looks mentally deficient, as that Axios interview would tend to indicate, in a different way, deluded, kind of Pollyanna-ish in a very peculiar way about what's going on. So maybe it doesn't matter what happens, the debates, the vice presidential, all of it, that we're sort of headed for November and that the national mood will be determined. We will understand the national mood by what happens on election day.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you can make that determination now. It's a sort of thing that will congeal in a retrospective. Looking back on the year, people will say, as Abe just said, whatever the outcome was inevitable and obvious at the time, even though it's not. But I would never sign on to the statement that suggests that events cannot alter the trajectory of this election. I was trying to say that yesterday. I've been trying to say that for a while. There's a lot of game left to play. And I don't think you can say that. I don't think it would be fair to say that Donald Trump is doing as well or better than he was in 2016. At no point has he led in any poll ever. No, I'm sorry. Going back to February was the last time he led in a national survey, as opposed to 2016, where it was a single digit race, even before the conventions. And Donald Trump had a period after the conventions where he led even in the average of polls. So I think he was doing markedly better than he was now. This is depending on it's a high single digit, if not low double digit race right now nationally. And state level surveys suggest that a lot of battlegrounds are in play, and Donald Trump is defending territory in places like Ohio and Florida that he cannot win without. The power of incumbency does confer some advantages, one of them being that you're in the game no matter what. You're never not going to be in the game. Particularly with the money machine that the president has. But he's not, I don't think he's doing as well as he did in 2016. And that does not mean that he can't rebound, but it is incumbent on Joe Biden stepping on a couple of landmines. It's not just that Donald Trump has to do better. Joe Biden has to do worse, and he can. And I think that the spotlight is going to begin to focus more on his campaign and him as a candidate, and not allow him to get away with the kind of, you know, bunkering that he's been going has been his advantage so far. That advantage is going to end after the conventions, but so far the trajectory of the race does point to Donald Trump losing and losing handily.
Okay,
but things can change in the fall.
Right now I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics chart of 2016, and Noah, you are correct that on several occasions, December 6, 2015, they were within a point of one another, on February 1st, 2016. I think it's, wait, is it February 1st? I'm trying to find this number here. February 4th, 2016, they were very close. And Trump led on July 27th, 2016 by a point. Now, what happened after July 27, 2016? The Democratic convention and Trump calling Khazir Khan, the father of the Gold Star hero, you know, like attacking him and assaulting the guy whose son had died as a, you know, military officer. At which point the polls started to spread kind of radically. And then on August 4th, in the Real Clear Politics average, remember I cited a poll in that Facebook post, one poll that had Hillary up 10. But on this date in the Real Clear Politics average, Clinton was up 6.8, Biden's up 7.4 now. So he is actually doing better than Hillary was. There was a pitch that Trump made in 2016 he cannot make now, which I think was probably more powerful than people realize for the voters who were genuinely undecided and broke toward him in the last week, which is when he said, "What have you got to lose? Give me a shot. What have you got to lose? You, her, you know, me, you don't know, but you know, I'm telling you, I can do a better job than she can. What have you got to lose? Give me a shot." And when Comey comes out and says they're investigating her emails again and all of that, maybe that idea was more, had real pull in a way that we didn't recognize in any way. And of course, now that's not him. That's Biden, right? That is, what have you got to lose? Look how terrible things are now. You know, give me a shot. What have you got to lose? It can't get any worse, you know? Maybe. And so if that was a powerful message, that's obviously, aside from the collection of issues that's bad for Trump, that he can't, that is an arrow he can't pull out of his quiver.
Well, and he can't also, the other message I think he used to great effect in 2016 that isn't available to him now is the outsider message, right? The drain the swamp message, which ironically now redounds to Biden's effect, because Biden is definitely a swamp creature if you're defining it the way, you know, as having been a lifer in DC. But that actually in the moment of crisis for many voters, I think is an appeal, not something that detracts from Biden's candidacy, because the assumption is he'll know what to do. And that's certainly been his message. Oh, I know, I've been vice president, I've been a senator, even though if you actually break down his record, it doesn't really comport well with the way the Democratic Party sits on important issues like law enforcement and crime and whatnot. But I think that's another part of that message that was appealing for Trump voters in 2016 that has lost its resonance.
I'm not sure. I think no one wants chaos and recklessness, but the outsider playing in our politics is somehow here to stay for a while, as something people want. It's not as if during the various things that have discredited Trump on several fronts, it's not as if the establishment in its several forms has bathed itself in glory simultaneously, you know? Our long trusted institutions nosedived along with Trump. So who knows?
Look, I mean, what I find is that both being, you know, an intensely close student of politics on a daily or even an hourly basis, and the kinds of things that I know and I see and that we all know and see and focus on, you have to spend your life trying to imagine what it's like when you're not a person like us and you are trying to digest political information and make decisions about what's going on. And it becomes very difficult to understand who's watching, who's paying attention to what's going on in the cities, or, do people really know? Are they, you know, they, you know, if you watch like when Jay Leno did those things where he would just, they would stop random people in the street and ask them, you know, like who George Washington was, and they couldn't answer the question or whatever. Who knows what the people who are going to decide the election actually know and don't know? And what is the impression that they have of politics? Is it, does it deepen over time? Or is it all kind of vague and impressionistic and affected by, you know, what the conversations they have with their friends or their, you know, or the people that are around them or something like that. And so it's really, really hard to say either a, what do you, this is where I think Abe's right that, you know, it'll all seem clear in retrospect, like that people are going to say, what are you crazy? The Democrats went insane. Of course, Trump won re-election. Or what are you crazy? Nobody was paying attention to that. Trump tried to go with this, you know, that he's in the hands of the radical left, but people are like, they don't have jobs and they're worried that the unemployment money is going to run out and they, you know, they don't know if they should walk around in masks or not. Like that's what's affecting them. They're not thinking about the condition of the country in some general sense. They have real personal concerns that are destabilizing to the status quo. And therefore, any effort that Trump might make to make a larger political, ideological case for his own reelection against Biden is going to fall on deaf ears. And I genuinely don't know how to sort through those, you know, those polls of reality. And they can sort of both be true. And then the question is, which silo in American life is more powerful than the other silo?
All right. Well, there's other tools that we can use to suss out the political landscape here and beyond just survey data. Just take a look at the two campaigns. Which one is acting like they're in trouble? It's pretty clear from their perspectives, who perceives themselves to be behind the eight ball.
But that can be delusional. This is part of the threat to Biden. And this was the threat to Hillary. This is why Hillary lost, which is, it's very hard not to drink your own Kool-Aid. It's very hard not to get overconfident if you are a liberal Democrat and you are bathed in the attitudes and beliefs and convictions that are supported not only by the media, but by popular culture and, say, by your own kids who are in college or whatever. It's very hard to emerge from that smoke filter to say, you know, I better, like, go to Michigan five times in the last 2 weeks. Because we're not really firm in Michigan. And, you know, if we lose Michigan, we're going to lose the election. Somehow they didn't know that. Now you look back and you're like, how could they not have known that? And it's because they were ingesting the news the same way we do. We think they're like sane and sensible and, you know, like they're hard ass, tough minded politico types. But let me ask you this, Christine, in the world in which we live, Biden needs to sit down and have a conversation with his brain trust. And they're like, here are the vice presidential picks we have. Well, here's a hard way to have a conversation, a serious conversation. Does it help us to pick a black woman or does it hurt us? In other words, what we need to do is win back 85,000 Obama to Trump voters. Will it help us with them that I pick a black woman? Or will it actually, because they're racists, this is what they would think, they're racists and we all know that this is a racist country, so we better not inflame them, but try to like maneuver around them and not push their buttons. Now, can Biden in 2020, in July or August of 2020, actually have that conversation openly in his basement with his brain trust? I say the words can't even come out of their mouths. I mean, they can have some weird curlicue conversation where they raise these issues in incredibly delicate ways and no one will actually understand what anybody else is saying.
So the question being, is the Biden campaign itself so woke that it can't even have the quiet unwoke conversation about voters? And I think that's certainly probable. The other thing though that I think might be happening is, you know, Biden recently, and I'm talking about the last year or two, has not been great when you've put him in front of a crowd. He's been very thin-skinned and testy. And, you know, he's had a couple of little outbursts that were caught. Setting aside the kind of stream of consciousness gobbledygook way he sometimes speaks, he really has not been a great retail politician out there recently. And so I think the longer they keep him in the bunker, there's a very delicate balance. There's a real tipping point where if he's in the bunker too long and he's not out there talking to people and looking amiable and normal and un-Trumpian, it's going to not be great. And so once he picks the VP, maybe the idea is they go out together and that person is more personable. And I still think that the fact that they're vetting people that are extremely radical left, the kind of VP candidates who would never be considered on either side of the aisle in previous eras, now being, you know, publicly vetted, is either, like we talked about yesterday, either a really strategic game of 3D chess or a sign of what you're pointing to, John, which is that it's the campaign itself is woke enough that they think we're going to push, you know, the American people are ready for this because look at the George Floyd protests. The minds have changed. Let's move forward in this progressive direction. In which case, yeah, I think that's going to help Trump.
Doesn't the whole logic of the Black Lives Matter movement and the philosophy that we are being drenched in at every moment suggest that the last thing he should do is pick a black woman? I mean, seriously, like, they say America is an irredeemably racist country. There's structural racism. And we know that the single largest voting bloc in the United States, if you want to consider it a bloc, are white working white people who did not attend college. That is the largest cohort in the United States electorate. And according to them, they're all monsters. So if you need him to win, and you need him to win in order to, like, fight back against those people, then you can't awaken the sleeping giant of racist evil.
No, I think
Karen Bass.
But remember, they have contempt for that chunk of the electorate. I don't know if Biden personally does, but that was Hillary's, it's the deplorable problem, right? There's a certain sensibility among progressive enlightened liberals that actually they have to force it on that part of the population. It's time to, you know, they're on the wrong side of history. We hear this, you know, mentioned all the time. So I actually think it could go either way. Like, if they actually think that that's going to help them bring all those voters into the 21st century, then they will do it, because right now they have a pretty weak incumbent to fight against. So now is the moment to do that, right?
Well, let's apply some perspective here. There's very little indication that Joe Biden or his core the core advisors around him believe that we should transform 2020 into a referendum on American race relations. They've done everything they can to avoid that topic. And I think it's pretty hard not to foresee that on November 4th, if we're looking back on a Biden loss, it's because they lost sight of the issues around the election, which are the economy and the virus. There's some people around Joe Biden who want to transform this into a referendum on race. And Donald Trump's campaign has been doing everything they can to force Joe Biden into this box, which is not hard. It's hard to avoid. There's a lot of people around Joe Biden who want this to become a referendum on American race relations and to be a reparative and restorative election. And Joe Biden clearly doesn't want that. Donald Trump does. So it's not just that he's fighting his progressive left flank. The fact that this is being forced on him by his Republican adversaries makes it an easier trap to avoid.
That's what I would think. But I'm saying I actually don't agree that this is an irredeemably racist country that would look with such disfavor on the choice of an African-American woman that they would then, you know, turn to Trump because it's an African-American woman. I do think that it would be insane for him to pick somebody who went to Cuba with the Vence Ramos Brigade and then sent words of mourning on El Jefe on the death of Fidel Castro, sucked up to the Scientologists and was palling around with the head of Nation of Islam in California. That would be crazy. That's Karen Bass. Karen Bass is a nobody who has only been made into a somebody by this presidential veep stakes. And so the idea now, it seems to me, this is a very telling moment, because if if she wasn't knocked out last night by the revelation of her kind words and photographs with Nation of Islam figures, then I don't know that the Biden campaign is what I think it is, which is what I think Noah described. He hewed very closely to this line that he was going to say as much as he needed to say to not be openly offensive to the woke revolution while not being a part of it. And maybe this has now advanced over the last 2 months so far that that's no longer the case. Could also be that they're floating Karen Bass precisely because they're trying to make the case for the other people that they're going to pick.
See, I thought you can make that case, but not anymore. Not after the flack she's taken in the press. She went out there to show that she can, to take the slings and arrows and draw fire from the nominee. That's the job. First, do no harm. But she's done a lot of harm in the vetting process. I don't think they anticipated that she would take this kind of assault when she was floated. If they did, then she should be really, really mad that she was hung out to dry like this from the Biden campaign.
Well, but part of the vetting process is you don't know how someone's going to read. You don't know that you are. If you say, "Can I vet you?" and they say yes, then it's sort of like, well, we're going to see what happens. And he extended his choice to next week, presumably because some of this had to play out. Now, as I say, I think she's probably done. And that therefore, the question now is, does this mean that all the buzz starts to fade and it's Harris, Rice, or Duckworth, and that's it? Or does Val Deming start coming up on the post because Bass is finished, and then she'll be elevated, floated up there to see what kind of fire she takes? And then maybe if she survives it better for a week, then maybe she gets picked. I don't know. I mean, if Bass is out, then this was a very successful vetting process. They put her name out. They gave people 2 weeks to do oppo on her. Chuck Ross at the Daily Caller has done amazing work in this regard. And so now they don't, their hands are clean. They didn't have to like elevate her and then go, "Nah, you can't get it." Like, it's more like, you know, other Democrats aren't going to want her to have it either. I don't know. That's,
As I think about it, I don't think that this was a case of their putting her out there so that their eventual pick by contrast will be more palatable. Because as Noah says, I mean, the result of this really is that Biden, the campaign now has some association with her and her associations by extension. However briefly, you know, it's not good, I don't think, for Biden, you know, in any way to have gone through this with her.
Well, if he doesn't pick her, he can't be accused of picking her.
Sure. Sure.
That's all I'm saying.
If the part of the message on the part of the Republicans here and if part of the fear among Democrats is that they will be associated generally with radicalism and extreme ideas, this was another data point.
I think that's true, because I think if she's even within the realm of possibility of being vetted, then that is a signal of where the party is right now, because they're looking at a range of candidates, and she's on one end, and you know, maybe you'd say Kamala Harris is on the other. But I agree that actually signals something about what they consider within the realm of the mainstream Democratic Party, because those are the only people you vet for vice president.
Right.
But how long have we been saying this, that Joe Biden's liability is the party he leads?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That he's surrounded by these people who have gone much farther left than him in the 4 years that he's been out of public life. And he's got no choice but to go to war with the army he's got. And it's incumbent on the Trump campaign to make that the issue insofar as they can, because the economy and the pandemic aren't moving in their favor. But you are fighting against the tide there. Those are the two dominant issues. And if Donald Trump is putting a lot of pressure on the Biden campaign to address this stuff, he might be able to force it on them, but it will be by force. The Trump Biden campaign will just through centrifugal force be inclined to resist the pressure to address the radicals on their own side.
What about during, what about the debate question, which, you know, we still, do we have any? I don't think there's a single scheduled debate.
No, there are three debates.
There are three. Okay. What? Okay.
What? The first one.
First one is now sponsored by a hospital.
Right. Yeah. It was going to be, no, it was. It was going to be at Notre Dame. And now it's, yeah, now it's at the Cleveland Clinic or something.
Oh,
right?
Boy.
Very fitting.
What?
Good.
It's fitting.
Right. I think September 29th is the date of the first debate.
And the Trump campaign has begun to make an issue, and rightly so, that the Presidential Debates Commission has not addressed the fact that this is a very unique election in which a lot of people will be voting by mail, and voting by mail starts weeks before the first debate happens. And the Trump campaign is saying, we want a whole bunch of debates and we want them earlier, and good for them for doing so. The Trump campaign, again, is acting like they're behind, because they are.
Right.
And the Biden campaign may not be well served by trying to hide their candidate forever.
Well, see, this is an interesting point because Trump, the outsider, went with an outsider structure for his reelection campaign. Right? They picked Brad Parscale. They did this. They did that. The whole thing election was on Facebook. They've spent $870 trillion to get themselves to 41%, which is where they've been the whole time. And now they basically have put in a political operative as the campaign manager, who is doing what a standard issue political operator does, which is, you know what? Actually, we have to live with the realities that exist. The reality exists is a lot of absentee ballots and voting by mail. And so rather than stand around saying, we're about to unleash the Death Star on you, let's actually deal with reality as it is and shift the debates earlier so that people who are going to vote by mail can do so with better knowledge of the order of battle. There's one problem with this theory as a matter of course, which is that you have to assume that the people who are going to vote in September have already made their minds up. Like, none of them is going to be as a voter is going to go, okay, well, you know what? I was going to vote for Biden, but I just watched the debate and I guess I have to vote for Trump. Like, I don't think that people who want those ballots, those mail-in ballots, have them in hand, are going to start mailing them in, you know, in August or September, know who they want. And they're not going to care.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Just because voters are generally far less ideological than we are. We had this conversation around Amy McGrath's nomination in Kentucky for U.S. Senate to face Mitch McConnell, is that a lot of people were voting before the Democratic Party was seized by this moment that occurred after the killing of George Floyd. And her opponent, who's an African-American, did far better than we thought he would based on polling, perhaps in response to this moment. And how many people, and a lot of those votes came in absentee and were voted on weeks and weeks and weeks ahead of time. And a lot of people perhaps probably would have taken their vote back if they could have. Events do change the trajectory of elections, well, and not necessarily based on the candidates.
But that's actually why early voting is bad, right? I mean, it actually is right. Bad. And people, you know, we're going to live through this whole thing about how there are no difficulties with, you know, because Trump is Trump and handles these things with a sledgehammer. There are major issues with early voting and mail-in voting and all of that. There are serious issues relating to potential massive fraud. They're really
go back
really
to 2016. If you cast your ballot before October 30th, you cast a vote for a candidate in Hillary Clinton who you suddenly discovered was under a criminal investigation by the FBI.
Right. But it also
changed the trajectory of the race.
The other thing that will change the trajectory of the race in that sense is that it will not make sense to save the late hit. You know, the classic thing in every election season until the now was that in the last campaign saved a story to drop on their rival if they had a really good one and kept it under close hold to see if they could depress the vote of the rival, right? The most successful one being George W. Bush's DUI, which Karl Rove estimates cost Bush 3 million votes. He's not doing that to like make his life easy. I mean, I think they actually have actual data that they saw this massive slippage. They were even looking at, you know, to put, they were starting to contest in California because he had some weird surge in California that just vanished the minute that the DUI hit. So these, you know, then there was the failed hit on Bush in 2004 about this, the missing weaponry from the arms dump in Iraq that just, that didn't take off. But if you're going to have a late hit, you're going to have to release it by Labor Day. Right, you know, if there is a thing, and obviously the thing for against Trump is going to be Cy Vance, the Manhattan DA, and whether he can gin up an indictment of Trump on fraud charges, which is what we heard about yesterday with the tax returns. You know, can he come up with something fast, quick, and dirty that can, you know, that can be used as a, you know, as a hammer against Trump.
By the way, I think that's a terrible late hit because the tax issue with Trump has been sort of, you know, beaten and fizzled several times in several ways.
Well, right. And there was the fraud. There was the Trump University fraud in 2016. He was, in fact, I mean, there was a civil settlement, right? In the middle of 2016. Which basically is a kind of admission that the fraud happened and it didn't obviously.
Not legally. A settlement is not an admission of fraud.
I know.
Well, I would say, you know, that's the old rule, right? That if it's going to be a late hit on Trump, it's got to be a sex scandal for people to actually take notice. Financial scandals don't tend to, I mean, we had this with the emoluments. Right. I mean, I actually think if you want to make an argument about Trump's corruptibility and the corruption of his family, there's a pretty serious one you could make, and you could look at how he's, you know, at what's redounded to his business empire while he's been president. But the average voter doesn't have the time or inclination to dig deep into that. And I agree. It sounds too much like previous attempts to attack him. And
I mean, there's something otherworldly about this conversation, the notion that voters need some new source of information in order to really accurately judge Donald Trump,
no,
though they haven't formed an opinion.
The question is, let's go in reverse. I mean, do the Trump people have something on Biden? You know, will there be a late hit on Biden? And that is something that Parscale might have mishandled, but that Stepien presumably will not mishandle. If they have something, he will drop it in a way that will be helpful, you know, electorally. But again, in the world of art, can Democrats and liberals lie to themselves about how they're going to win and therefore mishandle the next 3 months and walk themselves into defeat? Some of this does come to that, which is like they want there to be bad stories about Trump. They can't get enough of them. They're buying 2 million people have bought this book by his niece who has seen him once in 20 years, you know, in the last 20 years, and who, you know, basically spends most of the book doing armchair psychoanalysis of him like she knows any, because she has an MA or something in, you know, in social work. And so, you know, you could write that book. I could write that book. There's nothing to it. But, you know, they cannot get enough. They can't get enough. So they want it and they will hit it. And it's like this Jonathan Swan interview, which is horrifying. I'm sorry. Go ahead and watch it. I wasn't going to watch it. Jonah Goldberg made me watch it. I watched it just before we started this. And I couldn't believe my eyes. I just couldn't. But, like, that's not going to change anybody's mind. Nothing is going to change anybody's mind. He's the most well-defined person on the planet Earth, Trump.
I don't know. I think you can saturate television with the phrase, it is what it is, referring to the mountain of death resulting from the COVID infections in this country, and maybe animate a couple of voters who would otherwise be 3 in the enthusiasm scale to 6.
Maybe. But I mean, again, remember, a 3 to a 6, if the person's going to vote, it doesn't matter where they are on the enthusiasm scale. That was the great lesson of Obama.
But they weren't going to vote, and then they voted. Okay. That's the point, GOTV.
Okay.
You can do GOTV that way.
Well, maybe you're right. I don't know.
The president steps on his own toes all the time. Yeah. The problem is that he's talking too much. What the Trump campaign needs is Joe Biden to have the spotlight. And they'll get that time. That time is coming, which is the events that are going to shape the trajectory of the race. I do think that we're going to see tightening, and it'll tighten as a result of Joe Biden having to explain himself. But he doesn't, that's not we're not there yet. It's not, it's barely August.
It'll also tighten because as the news reports this week suggest that the GOP is doing a better job of registering voters right now in certain states. And although there's still a bit of the Democrats have done better in swing states, the GOP is finally trying to catch up and close that deficit in terms of the number of people who will ideally be turning out or mailing in a ballot on election day.
But arguably won Trump the race in 2016 was not necessarily James Comey. But when the James Comey letter happened, the Trump campaign disappeared. It dissolved. It ceased to exist. It was just the president was just background radiation. And Mike Pence took over and Reince Priebus took over. Paul Ryan took over. Those were the voices you saw in public after October 30. And it was all the focus was entirely an up or down referendum on Hillary Clinton. If they can get that dynamic again, that, you know, we've been talking about how voting happens now for 6 weeks. So maybe that's foreclosed upon.
But it's not foreclosed upon. And here's why. If you remember back to Florida, right? So in the week before Florida tallied, before Election Day, there was this early, but it was essentially like 10 days of voting in Florida where you went and you voted at the polling place. And for reasons that continue to elude me, they knew what party people were in when they voted. I don't know how they knew this, but they knew this. So they were going and they knew on Election Day that 250,000 more Democrats had voted before Election Day than Republicans. And all week we were like, well, he's done. You know, look at that. The enthusiasm gap, I mean, that's a big gap, right? 250,000 people, yada-da, blah, blah, blah. And then came Election Day, which, as Noah pointed out yesterday, is when Republicans traditionally have voted. They don't use these other modalities. And the Election Day vote just swamped this early vote. And there was that moment at, I don't know what it was, 8:47 p.m. on election night, when it suddenly became clear that Trump was going to win Florida. And I remember standing on a subway platform at 42nd Street going home and saying, oh my God, he's going to win this maybe because he had won Florida. And literally everybody in the world said, because the early vote had been harvested this way in Florida, that he couldn't possibly win. Yeah, I don't know how this early mail-in stuff is gonna, how they're gonna tranche it off, how it's this, and whether there is some way, but maybe they're gonna do it to themselves again. It's like Lucy in the football. They're gonna convince themselves that there's so much early voting that they're gonna win, and then it's gonna turn out that they're not gonna win because they were overconfident, and then they made moves based on their overconfidence, which is whatever the Trump campaign is going to be, just as was true in 2016, as you say, Noah, they are not overconfident.
Well, and he's more an irascible street fighter and kind of he enjoys the fight. I mean, I think part of the problem for the campaign is that he probably wants to be unleashed more and get beyond Twitter more and saying, you know, constantly responding to everything the Democrats do and say, and they're trying to rein him in. Biden is the opposite. And Biden's message, I think, of, you know, return to normalcy, I'm going to be the calm person, you don't have to worry about me on Twitter, is effective if you're trying to project yourself as a you know, a certain kind of leader. But it's not great if you're a candidate, right? If you're in the mix of the battle with an opponent like Trump, you risk kind of, you know, sustaining quite a few body blows without responding.
So I just want to point one other thing out before we close here. And I sent this to you guys from my buddy and our contributor, David Bonson, who's COVID and markets, is a very useful and important newsletter that helps us understand what's going on a daily basis. David sent me an email, sent me and a bunch of people an email on New York City, on the results in New York City. So here in New York City, COVID is gone. There are basically 3 cases per 100,000 people of COVID. There were 57 cases in Manhattan on Monday, 57 active cases, 15 people hospitalized in Manhattan, a county of 1.6 million people. And for the last 10 days, fewer than 10 deaths a day. Again, a county of 1.6 million people. Why aren't we open? Why hasn't New York fully opened? Why can't you go to church or synagogue? Why can't you go indoors to a restaurant if you wanted to? Maybe people really don't want to. This is the, I thought we were, and Abe, you said this, yeah, I thought we were functioning on the basis of the data. Well, the data are here.
Not only are we not open, what's disappeared entirely are the benchmarks that we were shooting for to open, right? What? There's not even a number announced that would allow New York to have indoor dining, let alone open.
Because it's not happening.
Right, exactly
right. This is the final phase of reopening, right? Phase four. There is no phase five.
It's the forever horizon now. That's it.
Right. So, and this is where I only bring this up not because I want to just talk about New York City because I live there and it's a pain, right? I don't. I'm trying to use this to sort of look at the psychology of the war against COVID, which is that as long as somebody is getting it, everybody is getting it. As long as there is a kind of collective assumption that in the United States, if people in New York were getting sick, everybody was supposed to shut down and they didn't. And now no one in New York is sick, but other places they're sick, so we need to be shut down. And it is this bias, which is again what Abe has been saying for weeks, a bias for lockdown. A bias toward the notion that people actually want to be locked down, that it is more comforting to be locked down than to deal with the uncertainty of living without lockdown, but in a state of caution, right? I mean, basically, you have to live in a state of caution, wear a mask, maybe not go into a restaurant if you're worried inside, whatever.
But this is the same culture. This is the point at which we're now where, you know, I think people were a little too Pollyannish at the beginning of this epidemic saying it's just like the flu. I mean, we're now actually at that point, right? The risk is similar for people in New York City as it would be for the seasonal flu, which will return in the fall, by the way. So there's a strange, I mean, maybe it'll take the number of people who are hospitalized as we regularly see every flu season as a contrast to those with COVID. To get it into people's minds about the risk they have long lived with before this pandemic hit. But it is kind of astonishing that for me, the concern is that the benchmarks have disappeared because that's a way of reasserting a set of qualifications that didn't exist at the beginning and that are kind of having it rewriting the history of how we plan to deal with this and also how public health officials told us we should deal with it. That concerns me a lot.
Well, it also speaks to the power formula, which is that if you set the benchmarks, then the benchmarks are set and the politicians aren't just exercising power willy-nilly. They are following guidelines, following independent standards so that they're not just making decisions like the Montgomery County, Maryland Health Commissioner announcing that no private school or parochial school should open. Because who the hell is he to make such a decision on the basis of what? What is his decision made? You know, he's a little local fascist, literally making determinations that are not in his writ to determine. So we want these independent standards so that we're protected against Andrew Cuomo, basically.
So, yeah.
And Andrew Cuomo should want them for that reason. But in the old formula that we had back in May, when I said, when it was necessary politically, then it would be deemed that we were over COVID, right? This was my formulation, that we would be deemed to have won the battle at the point at which the politics flipped on the politicians. And I think based on Muriel Bowser in D.C. saying that schools wouldn't open until after Election Day and the way Cuomo has disappeared his on all of this, we will be deemed to be over COVID when Trump loses. that there is an inherent bias in blue states and with blue politicians and with blue voters and the media and everybody like that to say that everything is terrible until the moment at which the orange demon in the White House is extirpated. And Cuomo, without that, it's not going to happen.
Cuomo virtually went on a rant to that effect yesterday, saying that Donald Trump is a comorbidity of COVID. He is the complicating factor. He is the problem.
The idea is you're saving lives by not reopening until you have a competent president in place,
right,
who's CDC does the right thing, not the wrong thing, who isn't putting pressure on public health officials. No, that's actually a very succinct way of expressing this, but that is not the game we were told was going to be in play, months ago.
By the way, and none of this has stopped Cuomo from declaring victory and taking a victory lap. New York has done great. Everyone should do what we did. Still can't open up. But we've killed it. We've nailed it.
I mean, this is what we're talking about with regard to events. So we should specify that the places that locked down, irrespective of their case counts again, and were like launched into a reimposition of lockdown measures, were basically the West Coast and the East Coast, Northeast rather, really dark blue Democrat heavy states, where the political incentives are to pursue a maximalist lockdown policy and there's very little incentive to pursue anything else. But it's not the case in more Republican-led states, Texas and Florida and Arizona and what have you. Those Republican governors have received some poor marks from their citizens. Their job approval ratings collapsed as a result of the perception that they reopened too early, what have you. But all of those states, especially in the Sun Belt, are seeing case rates decline. As we talked about, the R-naught in New Jersey and Rhode Island isn't particularly great now. It's over one, which is not where you want to be. But their overall case rates are very stable and low and have been for months now. New cases in this country over the course of 14 days are down by 9%. And the death rate, while up from May, is on a downward trajectory. So where are cases rising now the fastest in this country? Hawaii, nobody saw coming. So this is the theory that Abe's been talking about forever, is that if you didn't get your first wave, you're going to get it. Eventually you get it, no matter what. It's far less deadly now than it was in April and May. And you could see this thing level off and decline and not face this kind of deadly second wave that everybody anticipates in the fall, and yet still have the kind of onerous lockdown measures because of these political incentives that are entirely untethered to case rates and COVID. And the disparity between those two things will become a source of frustration, particularly for Republican voters. But those independents who are independently minded and those swing voters who are independently minded will look at this disparity and be very frustrated, perhaps, by the restrictions that are placed on them based on nothing other than sentiment.
And this, again, is where the media and cultural atmosphere could lower a fog on Democratic politicians and the people around Biden so that they overplay their COVID hand. But Cuomo saying that Trump is a comorbidity causing COVID is very much on the line of what he or any Democrat should be saying. They can imply it. They can hint at it.
Pelosi's been saying something similar for the past week.
They have. It is a danger to them to do it this way, to say that a person in power, that a person is responsible for killing people, that a disease is killing. That is a line that is very tentative to cross. And we know from Rich Thaw that swing voter focus group stuff that we talked about yesterday, if people were listening. These focus groups in sort of like Obama to Trump territory, that those people, if you think that they're representative of independent voters who might go either way, did not like the idea of blaming Trump for the virus.
I'll tell you what else is risky in the same way. The New York Times coming out with an article, I think yesterday, stoking fear about an eventual vaccine and the vaccine program because it's associated with Trump.
Right. So the whole question there is the everything is terrible and Trump is terrible and everything is terrible. Is that at some point, are people going to say, you know what? I don't want to hear this anymore. Like, it's enough. You know, hasn't done well, fine. But you're like accusing him of being a mass murderer. And that just goes, I know you think it, but I don't think it. And that just goes too far. I think that is plausible. And it's also plausible that that attitude will not surface in the understanding of the media and liberal Democrats and even the Biden campaign. Even though, again, they need to be looking very hard at their own assumptions about the electorate that Hillary Clinton misunderstood in 2016 and do what they can to win back enough of those people so that if there's a close election, they get those 22,000 voters in Michigan they lost and win by a razor-thin margin. And not be seduced by the fact that Biden is up 70-30 in California and in New York, because we don't matter. We're not going to decide the election. I'm not giving them advice. I just think that there is a kind of worldview in which seeing that post that I put on Facebook reminded me yet again of the fact that it is very easy to misunderstand what appears to be an open and shut case for something if you don't re-examine your assumptions on a constantly shifting basis as the facts change. So with that, we will say goodbye till tomorrow. For Abe, Christina, Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.